men historically have grown up in a situation where any sort of expression of emotion is a sign of weakness, and that weakness is counter to what people would mistakenly call masculinity, when I actually think true masculinity allows for emotionality, but does it with stability and with that strength and with, again, the healthy expression of emotions.
And that's part of the divine masculine, to be okay to be sensitive. You can be sensitive and strong. Those are not opposites.
This is the Gutsy Health Podcast, your go-to destination for uncomplicated, practical, and affordable tools for your wellness education with Johnny Grover. Are you ready to become a self-healing champion? Let's go. Hey, everybody. Welcome back to the Gutsy Health Podcast. I have two of my favorite men on the planet here podcasting with us. We have Dr. Ilir Gogoris, who is like a second dad to me. And we have my husband, Ryan Grover. Welcome back, honey.
Also a second dad.
Stop.
I told you I'm going to be goofy.
But I'm your second dad to both of you. I mean, that's how it is.
Exactly. If you guys have heard some of my older podcasts, Dr. Ely has been on the podcast twice. He's written the book, Seven Paths to Lasting Happiness, as well as Seven Keys to Navigating a Crisis. And so, like, were both of them bestsellers on Amazon?
The Happiness was a bestseller. The second one was a quick book, the first book to market in the world about the pandemic, how to emotionally deal with pandemics and other disasters.
Yeah.
And yeah.
And that was very timely.
Like, very timely.
That was a very timely episode. And so people know you as the happiness doctor. Like, you just exude happiness. And what's really funny, many of you actually have follow me on Instagram. You've seen Ryan on Instagram, and like, he's just like sunshine. But the story behind Ilir, it's funny because I flew out to Colorado. Ilir is like my best friend, you guys, and he's like a dad to me. We have this like really beautiful relationship. When Tristan was dying, I think I was on the phone with you every day.
Every day.
Like, you were my rock and my anchor. Like, you were the person that saw me like the clearest. And like, you were the one person that I had to keep my shiz together, right? For everyone around me. But I fell to pieces with you. You're the only person strong enough to like help me bear my burden.
I was your rock.
You were my rock, because no one else could do that. What I was going through was so intense and so heavy, and it terrified people. It really did. And so I couldn't really talk to them about it, except with you and Gina. So I called you every day. And then Tristan, sorry guys, you're going to hear kids come in and out. We're having bets on how many times we're going to be interrupted. Ryan, you've guessed three times.
Three minimum.
I guess five.
I'm saying five. Oh. Four more
five
to go.
Times. But it's interesting because Tristan died. And then I remember I flew out to Colorado to visit you, and I was crying in your backyard on the swing, and you're sitting there with me, and we were holding hands. My head was like on your shoulder. And I was like, Dad, I need to meet someone that's exactly like you, but just 20 years younger.
And taller.
That's what I said. Because you're just light and love and happiness. And it's funny because 3 days later, Ryan and I go on our second date, and I call you and I'm like, Daddy's just like you. I was like,
and the rest is history.
And the rest is history.
You know what's really interesting? The first time I met you, Ryan, and we hugged, I swear to you, the spirit, the universe, God, the higher self, whatever, told me he's going to be one of your sons. I knew it. Yeah. And you had just started dating, really. Yeah. It was less than a month, really. Yeah. And I just knew it. It was family. It was like a remembering of one another. Mm-hmm. It was like a younger version, you know?
Right. It's like
taller and more handsome.
Exactly. But you guys are like the same human. It's ridiculous. I wanted to bring you both on this episode just because the Gutsy Health Podcast, as I'm evolving, it's evolving. It's been primarily like me talking about health and nutrition and like nourishing the body, but I'm moving more into a space, and I have been over the past year or two, where soul meets science, right? And I want to start talking more about soul topics. Like, how do we evolve our hearts and our minds and our bodies and our souls? And so what's really important to me is the evolution, not just of our own personal health, but the evolution of the world and the evolution of the next generation, right? The world inside us, as well as the world outside of us. And so this is one of those topics where it's like, let's talk about things to help bring in a higher consciousness. And whether that's us now as adults, or having conversations with our children, or just the way we parent our children. Like, how are we navigating that? And so today I want this episode to be about raising our boys to become divine masculine men. I think there has been this, you know, there's been this like feminist movement, but it's been a little like parts of it has been toxic, where it's like elevate women and like men need to keep quiet and be subservient, right? And I don't think that's healthy feminism. I think feminism, the true feminism, is everyone is raised and everyone is equal. And so, but then there has been toxic masculinity just because of the pain of boys. I don't think we've been raising our boys well, right? And I want to talk about that. And I want to talk about the mistakes that we have made and how do we raise our beautiful boys to embrace their sensitivity, to become strong, masculine, like conscious masculine men, right? Divine masculine men, because it can be done. And it doesn't have to be through anger and violence. And, you know, the thing that we tell boys is like, don't cry. Like strong boys don't cry. Real men don't cry kind of thing. And I think that's very damaging. And so I want to talk about that today. Who wants to head up the topic?
I can go first. So I grew up in a Greek home with a kind of a tough Greek dad. He was a Korean War veteran, tough guy, cussed a lot, drank, smoked. You know, he was just, although he sacrificed great for his family. And he taught me really how to love women because he adored my mom. He was in love with my mom. So he had a lot of positives that way. But he was old school. When I was like 15 years old, I remember my mom and dad were getting ready to go out on a date night. And I was crying about something. I don't remember the specifics, but I do remember how I felt, you know. And my dad came up to me and I'm just holding on to my mom. You know, I was 15 year old. I mean, it was, you know, a teenager. And he says to me, you're too sensitive. And it cut me to the core because you know what? I was sensitive. I was very sensitive. I am sensitive. Sensitivity is the core of my being. So what that did for me, of course, is like, I felt ashamed that I was crying, that I was a baby, like I was. So I had to like toughen up. And I recognized over the years that my dad was really trying to protect me because he felt like if you're sensitive, you're weak. Mm-hmm. And then the world is going to eat you up, basically. He wanted to toughen me up. So for many years, I didn't cry. It took me like 3 or 4 years. I didn't cry at all, nothing, because I had to be tough. And I recently did my own personal journey, and it was beautiful. And the insight and the download that I got, it was like when my dad was saying you're too sensitive, he was really speaking about himself. And he was rejecting himself because my dad, underneath all that bravado and all that toughness, was a very sensitive man. But in his generation, that was not even allowed. That there's right. No way. When he was saying that to me, he was really rejecting himself. That was his stuff. He had nothing to do with me. And actually, my sensitivity is one of the things that makes me who I am. And that's part of the divine masculine, to be okay to be sensitive. You can be sensitive and strong. Those are not opposites.
Right.
For sure. I mean, I think at its core, divine masculine is about the beautiful aspects of masculinity, which is assertiveness, which is power, which is being a strong leader, but doing that in very, very healthy ways, like healthy expressions of power, leadership, assertiveness, but also the strong, stable foundation. And I think toxic masculinity has so much been surrounded around the strong stability is not allowing the emotional expression of men because emotions are quick, they're transient, and men are supposed to be this rock stable foundation. And so your generation, my father included, but I think you're much younger than my father. We're very close in age. I think they did grow up. And I think men historically have grown up in a situation where any sort of expression of emotion is a sign of weakness. And that weakness is counter to what people would mistakenly call masculinity, when I actually think true masculinity allows for emotionality, but does it with stability and with that strength and with, again, the healthy expression of emotions, right? Because we can express anger. We talked about that. Masculinity is easy to assert, right? And to be anger. And those are emotions that are acceptable for men. I think the flip side, when a man shows sadness or sorrow or can feel some of those complex emotions, historically, that's always been looked down upon. And I think now we're moving into a scenario where millennials, Gen Z, all of these younger generations are embracing the fact that to feel and to express emotions is okay, especially if you do it from a very centered place and can stay in that stable foundation as a defined masculine man.
And what's really interesting, Ryan, you talked about leadership. So as an executive coach, I work with a lot of CEOs of companies and they're always about what is your mindset? You know, your mindset, a winner's mindset, a tough, you know, go-getter leader. And I actually tweak that a little bit. I'm like, your mindset is important, but what's even more important as a human being and as a man is, where is your heart set? And so mindset is a phrase. I don't even know if heart set is an actual phrase, but it should be, like, right? Trademark right now. Where is your heart set? Because that's where your power really lies, is in your heart. Mm-hmm. And women innately are much more comfortable and so much better than we are. And that's rewarded for us. It's not, but my feminine side is equally as important as my masculine side.
For sure.
And I think divine masculinity acknowledges their feminine side and loves it, and they don't shut it down. It's interesting because this global masculine, and if you guys can hear a baby in the background, that's Theo. That's Theo. That's just Theo hanging out with us.
He's the divine masculine.
He's
already.
So beautiful. He's such a sweet little boy. You know, it's interesting. I read this was years ago. I read when it first came out, David Baldacci's book called Man Enough. And it brought to light, for me at least, how deep the masculine wound runs. And it starts really young, because I would say raising Satori and Tennyson, obviously every child's personality is different, but I would say Tennyson was way more sensitive than Satori, right? And I've spoken to other mothers that have said their sons are actually even more sensitive than their daughters sometimes. You know, we talk about like mommy's little boy or something, and it's like, and then we teach them, no, you can't do that. No, you can't cry. You can't be sensitive. Like, from young, they are taught to detach from their emotions. From young, we teach them to isolate. From young, we teach boys to abandon themselves and what they're actually feeling in their bodies and their hearts, right? And so you say, are you heart-centered? I would guess that from young, boys are taught to detach from their hearts entirely. And then we raise these men that are very, very disconnected. And then we wonder, like, why do they not connect with their spouses? Why can they not connect with their children? Why can they not connect to anything emotionally? And they just go from like nothingness to anger.
But listen to your own language a little while ago. You talked about Theo. He's such a sweet little boy. See, it's okay to say that for a little boy. Mm-hmm. Can you say that when he's 15? He's such a sweet young man.
Right.
Can you say that when your son is getting married and he's like 25, 30. What a sweet man. Mm-hmm. And still be okay with that. It's natural for you to say, oh, he's such a sweet little boy. But why does that language change as boys become young men and become men?
Right.
It's interesting, because those just tap into gender stereotypes that I think feminism is working so hard to break down. So for example, we have women. There's an interesting YouTube video. It's a short YouTube, and I'm going to try to paraphrase exactly what happened. But essentially, these women, these young girls, they're asked, like, run like a girl. And they run fast, right? And then as they get older and older, older age groups, even young boys, they're like, run like a boy, and they run fast. And then they run like a girl, and then they run fast. But as they start to get to like 9 and 10 and 11, it's like, run like a girl or throw like a girl, right? And these once young girls who are like, rah, you know, like throwing as hard as they could, now have already kind of embraced these gender stereotypes of, oh, women don't throw the ball hard. And women don't run hard. Women run girly, and men run hard, and men are masculine, and right. And so we're already kind of touching some of those gender stereotypes that are so deeply entrenched in our society.
And how often do you hear, let's say, someone who's not really good at sports? I mean, you and I were natural in sports. We are natural. It comes easy for us. I mean, okay. But you've known friends and other boys that sometimes sports didn't come easy to them.
Sure.
And the put down was denigrated. You throw like a girl.
Exactly.
Right.
Or you run like
you
a girl.
You run like a girl.
That's the pejorative. That is like, exactly. That's the worst thing you can say to a boy.
Right.
Which is terrible.
Terrible.
Because again, like, divine femininity has a place, and women are incredibly capable. And so I love that idea of coming back to what, at I think its core, is divine masculinity, is healthy expressions of power and leadership, where feminism is seeking to assert women's rights as far as voting, women's ability to get equal pay, women's ability to have equal access to education, all of those things, women's suffrage that they fought so hard against. What they're essentially, in essence, fighting for is men to only assert healthy leadership and not manipulate or control a situation. I think it's really interesting, and I hope that we can step through some of those gender stereotypes, embrace the healthy feminism that is seeking for equality. There might be toxic, and I'm not an expert on this by any means. I'm sure there's toxic feminism as much as there is good feminism, and there's toxic masculinity as much as there's good
masculinity.
Divine masculinity.
Divine masculinity. Sure. And so finding that balance, that center path, and allowing each child to express themselves, each human to express themselves in whatever ways are natural to them. Because I'm like you, Ilya. All growing up, I cry easily. To this day, mm-hmm. I still do. I can watch a Hallmark commercial and be like, so beautiful. But I'm like, I'll go out and work on my truck with the best of them. And I love throwing balls and like getting, and I love being competitive. I mean, I was in the office the other day and we were just shooting the bull with a bunch of dudes. And I'm like, I'm the fastest car driver in this room. Mm-hmm. I'm like, we can go to go-karts and I will beat every single one of you. And we're all just kind of busting each other's chops. So there has to be that allowance of more gray and less black and white.
You know, what's interesting is I obviously know you two very well. And I know people that know you two very well. And you are equally as sensitive and loving and soft as you are firm and masculine and strong. And people feel very safe in your guys' presence. Children gravitate to you guys like magnets. Animals gravitate to you guys like magnets. It's crazy. And you laugh, but it, like animals sense that. Animals sense the gentle but strong and safety. And so do people, children, babies, you know. And so as opposed to, we do live in a world where women are actually really scared of men. You know what I mean? Women are terrified to be alone with men in a room or at a workplace because they feel like they're going to be bullied or taken advantage of. I mean, that was my upbringing. Like I was really terrified of men, even though my dad is a remarkable human, probably the, like it should be sitting in this room. You know, he's such a good human and so kind and gentle. And he really raised me, but really raised me well. But like, I grew up in a society where I grew up in South Africa, where you're more likely to be raped than get in a car accident. Right. And so that was my upbringing. Crazy. Yes. And so I was terrified of being out in public and someone raping me. Like that sounds crazy. Or assaulting or attacking.
All sorts of things.
Right. It's very, very prevalent for that to happen. Right. And so growing up with this, like men are dangerous. Men are aggressive. Men will take advantage of women. Men are unsafe. Like this is unfortunately the world that we are in right now. And in order to transform the world for women to feel safe in it, that also means we have to protect our men so that they are not toxic, so that they can actually protect the divine feminine. But the only way they can protect the divine feminine is if they allow themselves their divine masculine, which allows them to actually nurture their soft side too, their feminine side, right?
When a man is in his divine masculine, he's not intimidated. He's not overwhelmed having a strong woman next to him. He mm-hmm. actually praises her, supports her, adores her, mm-hmm. worships her, loves her, makes love to her, you know, yeah. all of those things. When you're toxic masculinity, on the other hand,
dominates.
And they feel abuses. Very intimidated.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, as a clinical psychologist, I mean, in my private practice, I work with thousands of women. 70% of my practice was actually women. And a lot of their husbands and a lot of their men did not want them to grow. How mm-hmm. weird is that? Like, they didn't want them to evolve and become stronger or become independent. Their wives or their girlfriends' independence threatened them greatly. Mm-hmm. That's toxic masculinity. When you feel secure within yourself as a man, you want to see your wife, your girlfriend, your sister, your daughter, your, you know, thrive and be successful. My wife's success doesn't diminish me one bit. As a matter of fact, it elevates me too to have somebody so great next to me, you know?
Right.
And that's after 33 years of marriage. Mm-hmm. And, you know, Sona is an incredible human. She's so powerful. Her success, it doesn't diminish me. Mm-hmm. Nobody else's because it diminishes me if I'm in my divine masculine.
Right. And in your center.
Exactly.
The interesting thing, the thought that came to my mind as you were just talking, Ilya, is at its core, I think divine masculine is being centered and immovable in that center place of your own peace. And at its very least, being comfortable with the emotions that happen inside of you. So that goes back to Stoicism, Marcus Aurelius, allowing the world to be a storm and a tempest, but you're in the eye of the storm and you have peace. Because traditionally, that masculinity as a divine role is a stable foundation. It's firm. It's not moving. And it's assertive in its knowing intuitively the right direction to go. And women in their divine femininity are soft and emotional and open and movable, they're pliable, and they'll move.
And powerful.
Yes, and powerful, and all of the beautiful things that we want to talk about. So the thought that came to my mind was this. highly intelligent, emotionally intelligent people are capable with the discomfort inside themselves. And the greater their capacity to be at ease with discomfort in themselves allows them to equally sit with someone who's at discomfort or in a place of emotional distress. The thought that came to me was toxic masculinity asserts itself in anger. And so if, let's say you're in a bad relationship, a man who isn't comfortable with his own emotions is equally, if not more, incapable of dealing with the emotions of his spouse and will grow and get big and be angry to try to drive those emotions away.
To shut her down.
Yep, mm-hmm. To shut her down. Exactly. And so I think the more that we do work on our own inner states as men, we move towards that central place, that stability that then allows a woman to feel and be open and be expressive and powerful and playful and do all the things that a divine feminine wants to do, knowing that the divine masculine is that anchor, that rock. And it's interesting because even in our relationship, I'm nicknamed the hammer because at a certain point, Jeanique will just look over at me and she's like, and I'm like, yep, let's go. And there'll be times where Jeanique's like, oh, I just want to give in on this. And I'm like, no, this is the principle of the matter. Like, there has to be this firmness inside of this where it's like, no means no. Yes means yes and no means no. And these are the rules that we engage in. And so I love even our relationship and the beauty that we have because we do that dance so well, you and I. Mm-hmm. And I've come in and obviously in the last year and a half kind of tried to build structure into our lives. And I think that's a big core of my calling is just my divine masculine is to look at this family and create a safe container where everyone knows inside this sandbox, you can play however you want. But as soon as you butt up against that wall or try to step over that fence, I'm here to say no.
And I've witnessed you guys every month when I come out and visit and seen the influence and the impact you've had because you inherited not Jeanique, you inherited a family and the two kids, right? Yeah. And your firmness is done with love though. And firmness for kids provides safety.
Yeah.
If you were like all over the place and they could play your play, you know how often kids manipulate their parents. Mm-hmm. They play off one another, go to the, they find the weak link and they try to manipulate. And your firmness has softened Dennis up so much. He's not the same kid he was a year and a half ago. And all the credit goes to you, Ryan. It's wonderful to witness, you know, like a grandkid, to see him change so much before my very eyes. And it's because you are firm, but you do it with love. But there are consequences. And you're teaching him how to be a man, while at the same time, he can hold on to his sensitivity.
For sure. Mm-hmm.
So I want to talk about how we can nurture the divine masculine in our children, right? Because looking at Tennyson, he was very dysregulated. He was very reactive. He was really hard. Like he was a very hard, like even looking at your face, Ela, you're like, yes, he was hard. But underneath all of that is an extremely sensitive human. I would say like very, very sensitive at his core. He's just mush. You know what I mean? Like it's funny because, you know, I've spoken about him on social media a little bit. And I've had other moms be like, my son's the exact same, sensory sensitive.
But a deeply feeling child.
Yep. Yeah, very deeply feeling child, but they're extremely reactive, right? It's because they just do not know what to do with these deep emotions. Mm-hmm. And I remember one mom reaching out to me and she's like, my son's exactly like your son. My husband just wants to be firmer with him. And I said, no, please talk to him. Don't, like, we actually have to be softer. And so what does that look like? You know, when we have these kids that are emotionally reactive, right? And very reactive, how do we come back to our center and raise them to be safer? Because I remember, again, we came into your home very dysregulated. And one thing you always told me, you said, babe, it's the long game. It's the long game, right? Like finding our center and modeling to our extremely dysregulated and deeply feeling children. We have to model to them or mirror to them regulation.
It's borrowed regulation.
Borrowed regulation. Talk a little bit more about that for the parents out there that are like, I have a son who is deeply feeling. I have a son who is sensory sensitive and they lash out. And how do we nurture divine masculinity into our children when they're a lot to handle?
You said it's a long game, but you've done it in under a year and a half, which is remarkable to me. I thought it was going to take deep into his teenage years before you turn him around. And sure. The fact that you've done it so soon, You know, I took him to school the other day and was like our 5 minute with Tennyson. And I said, I got to tell you something. And he goes, oh yeah. I said, yeah. I said, I'm so proud of you because you're the oldest of four kids. Now you have a big family now, right? How loving, how tender, how encouraging you are, how supportive you are of everybody else. And he just lit up, you know, he got shy. He got his face turned a little bit red, but I wanted him to know that those qualities in a boy and eventually a young man, eventually a man, or to be encouraged.
Because there have been times where like Tennyson was like a thrashing animal, like a caged animal. Can you explain what your experience has been like to help not even tame him? Because for some reason, tame
just
seems
loving
like,
him. Right. That's essentially all it takes. And at its core, that's the central piece, is pouring in more love and just continually pouring in more and more love. In large part, the strategies that I'm using to help raise Tennyson to stay connected to his divine masculine, to help Story stay connected to her divine feminine, all revolve around new models of parenting. The models that we had are bad models, right? Like punish, control,
silence,
power games, silence, timeouts, where your emotions are so big that you can't be near me. When in fact, the opposite is what has to happen. Mm-hmm. So when our kids get bigger, I have to be more curious. And so the first step is always maintaining my center, always maintaining my ground, and then letting them borrow my regulation through their dysregulation. Mm-hmm. So that can be anything. I mean,
that's beautiful because I feel like he has borrowed your regulation, right? I mean, I see it. He has.
Yeah. Right.
He's becoming a lot more like you in a lot of ways. And it's so beautiful to witness a kid that was used to have meltdowns that were epic. For all the parents that I've had, kids who have epic meltdowns, Tennyson was like a 9 or a 10. Like his meltdowns were epic.
He did it great.
He did
everything
great.
He does great.
It was big. It was really big.
He goes all out.
Yeah. But to come from that and soften up and just the way you handle him, because ultimately he knows that you love him. And he also knows that you're strong enough that you can handle whatever he throws at you.
Mm-hmm.
He doesn't throw as much anymore because he's more regulated, right? But initially, even when you were trying to correct some of his behaviors, I mean, he would like go to the stratosphere. Oh, absolutely.
Oh, yeah.
You know, what's really sad is a year ago, he started therapy at school. Like the counselor would come. He reported to the counselor that I can't remember what the context was, but he told her like, yeah, my mom and I fight a lot. And I remember thinking like, oh, man, like I hate that. And a year later, it's like, oh, we've come so far.
Yeah.
Like we've come so far.
And I want to give you credit too, because it's not all me. I mean, you read, I don't know if you've completed it, but The Connected Child, which is a fantastic book.
Really good book.
I have a stack of parenting books that I'm working through. Mm-hmm. So Siblings Without Rivalry, Good Inside by Becky Kennedy.
Mm-hmm. That one's excellent.
The Connected
excellent.
Child, right? Mm-hmm. How to Talk So Kids Will Listen. There's really, really good models out there now that we have access to that our parents didn't. And so it's beholden for us as parents to step into the best practices to raise the best generation possible.
Right.
And even with Satori, she can go 0 to 60 really fast. Mm-hmm. And one of my favorite things to do with her when she starts yelling at me is to like bend over and get really quiet and just be like, why are you yelling at me? Because it's so disarming. And I get the reasons that she's yelling is because she feels like she doesn't have a voice and it needs to get louder so that she has a voice and can get heard.
The conscious parent on Instagram, she says, when they get loud, we get soft. And when they get loud, we get curious. Because if they get loud, you know, I love the example. I've spoken about this before, but it's like, pretend your brain is like a box. And when you are like we are, we're all in our prefrontal cortex. We're all regulated. We can drop into our heart space and feel love and connection, right? That's the prefrontal cortex doing its job. But as soon as we get triggered, I tell the kids, like, your lid flips. I indicate to them my lid flipping through my hand gestures. And it's like, and now your amygdala is turned on. And that's the lizard brain. And now your lid is flipped and you are dysregulated and you're angry and you can't reason. And like, all there is red. Like, you can't logic a kid out of their amygdala. So when kids get big, we have to mirror to them or show them what it looks like to stay in their prefrontal cortex. So we can't have them flip their lid and they're in their amygdala and then the parent does the exact same thing.
But that's typically what happens though.
Exactly.
Most parents go bigger thinking that if I go really big, then I will shut them down. And even if you do shut them down, you're not helping them.
No, because you're teaching them that part that's expressing themselves is so big and so scary
that my parent, who's supposed to be stable, firm, grounded, can't handle this part of me. So I have to shut that part down and push it away, whether it's through shame or just recognition of knowing that these big emotions are so scary that they scare my parent. Mm-hmm. I'm going to disassociate that part from me. And that's at its core what happens when we raise kids that aren't centered and that aren't connected with their true selves.
And that leads to toxic masculinity.
Yes, or
that
toxic femininity.
Or toxic femininity, right? And yep. So
where they're disconnected from themselves, they don't trust their own emotions, mm-hmm. they're not confident in their own intuitive voice, their own inner knowing, because they've been lied to their whole lives. They've been told that their emotions are too big. They've been pushed away. I can't mm-hmm. love you when you're like this. Go to your room.
Right.
You're too loud. Yep. You know, how do you, you're too loud. You
I have
know.
To be right. careful with that one.
Stop like, screaming. Stop
shouting
and,
in our house.
And the parent is mm-hmm. screaming at the child. Stop right. screaming. And they're out of control. So their child may get scared, but they feel so unsafe because the parent is out of control.
Yes. Right. Exactly. The parent is showing them, holy cow, even your emotions are too big for me. Mm-hmm. When, again, this is borrowed from Becky Kennedy in Good Inside. The very first thing that she always counsels parents as they're trying to reparent themselves and not get triggered is to take a deep breath and say to yourself, my kid is good. What's the most generous interpretation of their current behavior? And then become curious. So instead of punish, control, manipulate, or dominate through power, it's ground yourself, look at your child as a good kid, and then be curious as to why they're misbehaving. And the majority of the time, it's because there's a lack of connection with your child. They're dysregulated, or they're just dysregulated because they're little humans
right.
who don't know yet.
Their brains right? are not developed. Their brains
They've
are literally undeveloped.
Hour of video, or they played an hour of video games mm-hmm. and they're just way overstimulated.
Overstimulated, right.
And so they come mm-hmm. into this room and they're just a little bowl in a china shop. Mm-hmm. You don't know. They might have had a friend that did something mean to them at school and they come home and they don't know how to deal with that emotion. And so instead of looking at them and pushing them away, we have to pull them into us and draw them in and create language around the experience that they're having with emotions and show them that we can be connected with them through those emotions.
Right. You know, it's interesting because if we are parenting children who are, again, in their amygdala, the lizard brain, which is just like they're seeing red and they're screaming, and then we parent from our amygdala, we're just raising a generation of adults that will make really big and important decisions from their amygdala. And what we want to model to children is like, be in your prefrontal cortex, be in your heart, be in your heart space. I mean, if you look at the world right now, how much toxic masculinity there is, like everything that drives politics and world things is
war, violence,
mm-hmm, greed, money. This is all amygdala decision-making, right? Where the fear-based, where leaders cannot,
scarcity,
from their prefrontal cortex, make decisions that empowers and benefits the mass people, right? Mm-hmm. It's all about control and war and violence. And so that's not the world that we want to call in with the next generation, right? Like, we want a generation of men and women. We want to raise our children to have strong prefrontal cortexes, right? To have strong decision-making from their hearts and their soul spaces, and not from control and not from dominance and not from yelling and screaming and manipulating. That's what we're just drowning in these days.
You know, and I remember Tennyson when he was dysregulated, he's such negative self-talk. The things he would say about himself would break your heart. Mm-hmm. And now you're seeing this regulated kid who's happier because he feels like his own emotions are within control and they're acceptable. And he's softer, but he's stronger. The crazy acting out wasn't strength back then. It was just pure fear and terror. And of course, when you lose your father to cancer when you're 7, 8 years old and you've grown up most of those years around illness, I mean, we understand why he was the way he was.
Right.
But not to see him thrive.
I know.
And he's happy. Mm-hmm. I haven't heard a negative thing to say about himself in months from him, mm-hmm, coming out of his mouth. And it's so beautiful to see that. And as a matter of fact, he's encouraging Satori, mm-hmm, he's loving on little Theo, he's loving on Henry, like he's just so good. He's so beautiful.
For those that didn't see it on Instagram, we had Theodore on Thanksgiving Day. I had to be transferred to the hospital. We were having a home birth. I was birthing in the tub and we had to be transferred. We'll talk about that story another time. But when Tennyson and Satori walked into the hospital room, they just beelined to Theo and Tennyson was the first to hold him, and you just see him just, he melted into his little brother. And I said, do you like him? And he's like, I don't like him, Mom. I love him. And then he's just staring, and I'm like, are you okay, buddy? And you can see tears are coming down his face, and he's just crying because he's just overwhelmed with love. And that right there is beautiful, divine masculinity, where a young boy is so filled with love that he can look at this baby and his younger brother, and you know that he would do anything for him. He will take care of him. He will defend him. He will love him. He will nurture him. He will cherish him. Yeah. He will guide him. He will teach him, right?
He's so tender with him.
He's so tender with him.
Like, for a 10-year-old boy to be so tender with a baby, so beautiful to witness. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Just before we came in, I was wearing Theo in our little sling, and he'd just woken up. So I was wanting to wake up and feed. And so I put him out on the couch on his little safe spot, and he was just kind of like stirring a little bit. And Tennyson went over and just laid next to him. And I was like, okay, buddy, be careful. I don't want to wake him up. And he's like, it's okay. He's already awake. So then Tennyson just put his little arm around him and was laying there cuddling him as Theo's kind of waking up. So it is a really beautiful thing to watch. Tennyson's transformation through this change in paradigm. I think it's, again, coming back to a divine masculine where he has a safe structure. He has a safe home where he can come in and experience all of the emotions, because that's really what children are designed to do. Humans are designed to feel all of the emotions and not shut any of them down. And our job as parents is to create that safe space where any of the emotions that they're going to experience is okay.
Part of raising kids in the next generation is to stop saying there are good emotions and bad emotions. Because when you say that to a kid, what they interpret is that they are bad, not their, right? So
all emotions are welcome.
They shut it down or they act out even more. They double down on the acting out.
For parents that are out there that are like, well, if I raise my son to be soft and sensitive, he's always going to be soft and sensitive. Like, what do you guys have to say about that?
Great. There's nothing wrong with that. There are lots and lots of psychologists, a leading one in particular who I will not name, but he's like, I'm tough on my son because I want him to be ready for the world. The world's not kind.
Yeah, that was my dad to me, though. I can totally relate to that.
And the antithesis to that, the psychological term for that on the flip side, is just the devouring mother who gives and is soft and destroys her child because she's too soft on him. And then when he gets into the world, he's incapable of being strong, which is just, in my estimation, a bad worldview.
Right.
My viewpoint is, and falls more in line with some of the books that I've read. So I'm not arguing from authority. I'm just saying I've read some books that suggest that the best way to raise resilient humans, boys and girls, is to maintain a strong connection through whatever emotions they experience. Mm. To let them know that no matter what, I am a safe space for you. No matter what, Mom is a safe space for you. And we will be here with you. And that builds resilience. And so I'm more interested in my child's ability to deal with complex emotions than his ability to stay in a state of happiness. I don't care if he's happy. I obviously want my child's happiness, but more than anything, I want my child to be resilient because he or she knows without a shadow of a doubt that I am always here for them and that they are always connected, that they always have safety, they always have family, community, and love. And that will get them through whatever difficult circumstance they find themselves in. So it isn't me beating my son or being hard on him or harsh that's going to make him resilient. That's going to teach him to shut down emotions. So that when big, hard things come through, he just is like, I know what to do with this. I shut it down.
I'm really glad you brought the word resilience. When I wrote the second book, The Seven Keys to Navigating a Crisis, we looked at human beings in general, not boys or girls or men or women. When they're facing challenges, there's usually four ways they go about that. And the first one is like the victim, poor me. Like, why is this this always happens to me, poor me, right? The second one is they get mad and they go into blame. They blame everybody else. The third one is they get fearful and they're frozen in fear. They don't know what to do, right? And then the fourth one, of course, is they're navigators. They learn how to navigate through resilience. And when I first shared this with my youngest son, Dimitri, and to his credit, he said, Dad, I think I go to victim mode first. This is his own self-assessment. I didn't say anything. He goes, I get angry second. I'm a navigator. I'm not very fearful. And that's true. And I said, my boy, you know, in time, when you face challenges, we talked about navigating them. So it's been 3 years since we had that conversation. You know what? Right now, he's navigating life so beautifully. Yeah. He rarely goes into victim mode or gets angry. And he, of course, the fearful stuff, he never had that to begin with. And it's beautiful to see that evolution. So we want to raise boys and girls who are navigators, that navigate through all the challenges that we face. And those challenges are not going away. Satori's going to have challenges. We want them to lean into the challenges, not get afraid, not blame anybody else, or not get into victim mode. Because the other three, there's no personal responsibility.
No.
The navigators have an enormous amount of emotional intelligence. And the way that we raise children with emotional intelligence is, one, by being the safe space for them, and two, actually letting them explore their emotions and help them understand it. So when they are angry, we tell them, you're feeling anger. You're angry right now because this
language around it. Are you feeling anger?
Yeah.
What's happening?
A 20-year-old isn't going to act like a 4-year-old forever, right? Like, let the 4-year-old, with their 4-year-old developed brain, experience their emotion and just be that loving presence for them to navigate that. And that is what creates the emotional intelligence, so that when they're the 20-year-old, they're not shutting down. When the feeling of anger comes up, instead of them screaming at their coworker, they're going to be like, this is anger. This is how I cope with my anger. This is how I can see how I got into this position. For instance, a boundary was violated or something. And so I'm going to come back tomorrow, better regulate it, and I'm going to talk to my coworker about it versus I'm going to yell at my coworker right now. This is how we create emotionally intelligent children. And they're going to navigate the world far more intelligently and consciously than we ever did.
The beautiful thing is, as I've shared this message throughout the world, right, about the four different personality types, initially people think, well, Dr. Ely is the navigator and I'm this and that. No, it's human nature. Mm-hmm. All of us have all four of those inside
and
of
us. Experienced them at different
of
times.
Of course. Mm-hmm. And at times, even I felt like a victim. But the goal is not to become be a victim for 20 years, right. Be a victim for 20 minutes and then pivot and become a navigator again. So it's okay to 100%. Get mad from time to time. Sometimes you get mad at the government or whatever. But you don't want to stay mad for 6 months because you're only hurting yourself. Mm-hmm. Feel your feelings and then pivot and become to navigator, which is a solution based.
Sure.
I love that because, you know, it's interesting because yes, we are all of them. When we're in our lizard brain, when we're in our amygdala, we're going to go to victim because victim is low vibration. Victim is reactive, right? But what's interesting is, like you said, staying in victim or knowing, hey, I'm in victim right now. I'm in my amygdala. And here are the three things I need to do to get out of my amygdala and back into my prefrontal cortex. And so it's really beautiful because as we're creating this language around our children, my children can see when I'm dysregulated. And they'll even say, Mom, do you need a timeout? And I'm like, yes, I need 20 minutes to not talk to anyone. Like, I have to go and I have to regulate. Otherwise, if I stay in my amygdala, I show up as a bad mom. And they know that. And it's really cute. Henry, the other day, like the kids were like, are you mad, Mom? And I'm like, I am. And Henry's like, let's take some deep breath, Shanique.
and calm down.
And so he's like guiding me to take deep breaths. And it's beautiful because even when he's mad, he's like, deep breaths. So he'll start to take deep breaths.
He's a 4.5-year-old.
He's 4.5. And I will even remind him when he's angry. I'm like, do you remember the other day you reminded me to take deep breaths when I was mad? And he was like, uh-huh. I'm like, let's take some deep breaths together. And so he'll be angry and he'll take these deep breaths. And then after a few minutes, he's fine. He's like, I feel better now, you know? And so it's okay to get angry. That's part of the human experience, right? It's okay to be sad. It's okay to...
Or to be fearful from time to time. Mm-hmm. We all get scared from whatever, you know, we get triggered, 100%. We get scared, but you just don't want to stay in fear mode forever.
Right.
It's very interesting to me when you introduce that concept to young men or kids or young women, they get it instantly.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And they can identify this too. Remarkable to me just how they can self-identify what's their go-to response first.
Interesting.
Isn't it though?
Yeah.
So the main thing is not to stay stuck there. That's all. Right. It's not to have them because we all have them.
What's interesting is people that are stuck in victim mode, you can see that that's the product of their upbringing where they self-abandon all the time. And they don't have a lot of emotional, like no one modeled to them emotional intelligence.
But guess it takes its toll on their health physically,
100%.
Oh, yeah. Emotionally, mentally, spiritually. When you stay stuck in that mode, it's like in this loop and you cannot get out there. And they really don't know how to get out initially.
Well, unless it's modeled to them, that's tricky. Right? How do you then move through some of your own patterns? You first have to become aware of them.
That's number one. Awareness is number one. It's like, okay, you don't have to stay stuck in this mode forever. Do you want to do it? Let's be victims together for half an hour. Let's go, poor victim. Get the violins out, the full orchestra, the whole thing.
Yeah, and the Gregory.
Yeah. What'd you say?
Or the Gregory.
Or the Gregory.
Yeah.
Come over and tell me what we got.
Come over to my Gregory. Mm-hmm.
And then pivot. And, you know, the resilience that navigators have is, first of all, navigators are flexible and adaptable.
Yeah, they're not stuck. Fixed mindset versus a fluid mindset.
That's number one. They have a positive attitude. Like, in the end, this just shall pass. It's almost like the camera lens pulls back. It's like they have a perspective. Like, I know it's hurtful right now. I know you're in pain right now, but this just shall pass. Mm-hmm. And they believe that eventually they're going to. And then the more you do that, the more confidence you gain. The more confidence you gain, the better navigator you become. And then navigation becomes second nature. And then once in a while, you get the fear moment. Once in a while. But really, that's the exception to the rule, not the rule.
It's interesting, too, because I think there are things that have to happen in order to raise confident children and confident men. Because men can rely on bravado. Again, moving more into toxic masculinity, like charisma and bravado and braggadociousness. Versus confidence, a knowing. And I think a truly confident child, again, comes back to being comfortable with whatever emotional state is happening inside of them. One, being comfortable with it. Two, being able to identify it. You know, you can talk about like a child going to play in a soccer game and he's not maybe ready to go practice, right? If I grew up in a family where confidence was kind of tantamount, right? Like, I'd be like, what are you talking about? Get out there, go. On the flip side, the reverse might be more openness and curiosity about your child's inner state and allowing them to take part in whatever that activity may be when they're ready. So allowing them their own knowing and asserting that so that they build confidence in their own intuition and confidence in their own skin. And then the confidence in the physicality or the execution of different things will follow as their internal states become aligned.
And I want to differentiate something. Confidence is part of a divine masculine. Mm-hmm. Arrogance, toxic masculinity.
Yeah.
And when you see arrogant men, they're insecure little boys deep down inside. Yep, sure. Never mind all the big, all that arrogance underneath all that is someone who's very, very insecure. Because if you're secure, you can be confident. Because when you're confident, you don't put anybody else down. And somebody else's success doesn't diminish yours either. Exactly. Like, good for them. Like, that's great. That's great for them.
I did my best, right? And they beat me.
Arrogance, on the other hand, they're threatened.
Oh, yeah.
And when you look at narcissists specifically, I mean, that's the ultimate arrogance, right? Somebody who's narcissistic, they're just scared little boys.
Yeah. Totally. It's like this overcompensation.
Exactly.
Because they actually never, they've completely self-abandoned their entire lives. And two, they're looking on external sources of validation because they have zero internal voice telling them that they are worthy of love and existence. Yep. You know what I mean?
At its core, it's a lack of a consistent self-esteem. And granted, you can do all the ego work that you want because letting go of your ego, that has a point, right? There's definitely to understanding your own ego, but also allowing that your ego has to exist in certain circumstances. This arrogance is just this lack of a consistent self-esteem, this lack of a consistent identity, where confidence is, again, an inner knowing of what you really truly are, of who you truly are, of what you're feeling and what you're capable of. I love hanging out with you because we're cut from the same cloth. We'll joke with each other and I'm like, yeah, I can beat you doing that or no, but like, Ely is a phenomenal swimmer. Like,
phenomenal.
The wedding.
Oh my God.
Swimmer. And Janique thinks that she can beat Ely. And I have swum triathlon. I know I can swim for really long distances. I know I'm not fast over short speeds. And so it was fun watching you two go back and forth about who's going to beat who. And then somehow I got caught in the crossfire.
Janique used to be a swimmer too. And she thought she could beat me. And I'm like, honey, I don't think you can beat me. And even though I'm your dad. And so then at their wedding, Lake Powell, I got to race.
You didn't even get in and race.
Because I was pregnant.
She was pregnant. No.
Whatever. I was pregnant.
So Nick turns because if Ryan can beat you, then I know I can beat you. And I'm like, honey, Ryan is not going to beat me. Believe me.
And I knew but I loved it anyway. I was like, let's get in the water.
So you, your brothers to... and that other men, and we all raced. And of course I won, but it was fun. You know, it was competitive, but it was fun.
It was in the right spirit. There's no demeaning. It was just like playful.
Yeah, it was very playful.
Very fun, playful competition.
You know, and again, it comes down to you guys are some of the most, it's interesting. Eli, it's your birthday today.
Thank you. Happy birthday. Thank you.
And all the messages and texts that are coming in are just people that adore you. And something that keeps coming up as a theme for this week for you is your divine masculinity. Like people keep talking about it. And no matter where, like we went to Greece last year, you know, no matter where we go,
people are drawn to you.
It's almost like this hypnosis of like, you are charismatic from love. Mm-hmm. And so people instantly feel safe and they want to be around you, right? And that is beautiful, divine masculinity. And so for women that are like, I'm scared I'm going to raise too sensitive of boys, look at what they're going to turn into. You know what I mean? Like, you and Ryan are some of the most sensitive men, probably the most sensitive men I have ever met.
But and you can be most, sensitive and strong, though. Yes, those are not opposites.
They're not.
They're not mutually exclusive.
Yes, thank you.
Yeah. Yes. You can have both of them on the same, it's just two sides of the same coin.
Right. Like they coexist together beautifully to create divine masculinity, right? And again, that like, the point of this episode is if we are to call in a higher conscious world, we have to do better for our children. Mm-hmm. And so, and maybe our men right now, I want to joke and be like, you can't teach an old dog new tricks. It's too late for us guys. Kidding.
I disagree with that.
I'm kidding.
What? Fixed mindset. Wait, mindset. What? It's too late.
No, I'm just kidding. Okay. But like specifically for our children, like they deserve a better world. They deserve a softer world. They deserve a safer world. And the way we bring that in is by bringing and raising safer men. But and that starts with our boys.
Model what it that's looks like. And that's what you're so good at, Ryan. You just model it day in and day out consistently.
Yeah, thank you. I was going to say it starts with your own personal work. Mm-hmm. It always starts with you because you have no control over anyone else. So as soon as you work on yourself, your inner state changes and your outer state will follow. So if we want to raise or become divinely masculine men, my work is my own. I create a home that will allow that. I create a child who can grow up in that. And then that child can go out and do the same thing. He can become a man and he can work on his own inner state and build his own castle, build his own kingdom. And create safety and space for his queen and maybe his children and then the next generation. And that's how we stop generational trauma is first with ourselves and then with the people that we love most and then into our greater spheres of influence.
Yeah, I was going to say, and when we raise our children, I think it's not enough to tell them we love them. I mean, that's great, but that's not enough because that's easy. And after a while, it's like, love you too, as they're walking out the door. It's to spend some time and say, here's what I love about you, like I did with mm-hmm. Tennyson. I love your sensitivity. I love that you're such a great older mm-hmm. brother. I love how tender you are with Theo. Mm-hmm. I love how good you are with Satori. Mm-hmm. Like tell them what you love about them and not just their looks or their athletic abilities, but their character and their mm-hmm. who are they at their core.
It's interesting because as Tennyson is healing, instead of being this overpowering, overbearing, bigger brother who, you know, his siblings were annoying and he would yell at them and like want to push them away. He is now being protective and inclusive of them.
Soft.
And so, and soft, right? And so like Satori was sick the other morning and he went in and he like snuggled her and like spoke with her and got her a mashed banana and whatnot. It was like serving her. And that's him demonstrating the beginnings, like his young divine masculine of like, let me take care of you, right? The divine masculine takes care of, you know, I think of like righteous dominion. Like if you think of like, A good king takes care of their people. That is true, healthy king energy. Good king energy takes care of their kingdom.
Janique mm-hmm. taught me that king energy. There were a couple of things that I was with my wife and she's like, Dad, that's not king energy.
That was Peter Pan energy. I'm like, no Peter Pan energy.
Which Peter Pan has got me quite a few things. I mean, there are a lot of blessings of being Peter Pan, but no, it has,
I love
you know,
Peter
playful,
Pan.
Joyful and so on. But in some areas you have to be a man, like a king energy. Mm-hmm. And you taught me to show up as a king to mm-hmm. my wife and to my family. And I thank you for that because you raised the bar and mm-hmm. I achieved that bar, but I had to be challenged.
Yeah.
And I could take it from you. It's like, I didn't take it as criticism. Like I knew what you were saying was right. And I'm like, yeah, I need to up my game.
But
period.
And look at how your world
excuses.
Has changed.
I got to up my game. That's it. Yeah.
You know, but like before moving in with you and regulating myself, I would match Tennyson's dysregulation with my dysregulation, and how that would turn on his siblings is he would then use his dysregulation to be a domineering sibling.
Yeah.
Right. And so he was dysregulated
with his, your own dysregulation.
Yes. And so that caused a lot of sibling rivalry and sibling conflict and control and just more
power
control
struggles.
And power struggles. But since, you know, moving into softness and him being regulated, he is now including Henry and with all the things. Like when he goes out to play with his friends, they go, Henry, you want to play? And Henry's like, yeah. The other day was so cute because Henry was asking where Theo's room is going to be. And we're like, well, we'll have him in your room and you'll go downstairs and you get to pick a room. And he goes, I want to be with in Tennyson's room with Tennyson, you know, and it's just so sweet because before they used to fight all the time. And like they, I wouldn't say they hated each other, but
they're just trying to figure each other out.
Yeah. But now like Henry just worships the ground that Tennyson walks on, you know what I mean? And just wants to be like Tennyson and do everything that Tennyson and his friends do. And it's so great because he has these two cute friends that include all the young kids, you know, like the other day, Melissa, she is
good neighbors.
Yeah. We have great neighbors. And this little girl, Melissa, who was over here playing, she's the younger sister of Satori's best friend. She drew a picture for me. I was like, oh my gosh, it's such a good picture, Melissa. And she's like, let's go downstairs and show the boys. The boys were playing video games downstairs. So we go downstairs. I'm like, I don't know what response they're going to have. But this was divine masculinity. And so Melissa, she's, how old is she? She must be like
she's five.
You know, she's so timid and she's so sensitive. And so she goes up to Tennyson. She's like, Tennyson, look at my picture. And he takes off his Oculus and he's like, that's such a good picture, Melissa. Probably the best picture I've ever seen. And he looks at me.
She must have lit up.
He looks at me and shrugs and she just beamed. And then Tennyson's friend was like, Melissa, let me see. And he takes off his Oculus. He's like, that's a really good picture, Melissa. And I was so proud of them because these big grown boys to this five-year-old little doting girl, they made her feel like a million bucks.
Built her up.
That is beautiful masculine energy that they could take time away from their video game to show compassion and to just like praise her interest. Yeah. Like just like taking space with her and recognizing this is important to you. And I'm going to show you that it's important to me too. That is righteous dominion over your friend circle, right?
And I would say one last thing. If there's no greater proof that this is working, what you guys are doing is Janika and I failed. We said we're going to get interrupted 5 times. Ryan said 3 times, and we only got interrupted once at the very beginning. Uh-huh. That shows you the maturity.
Well, that's because Sona's out there with
us. Okay, all right. Give credit to my wife. I'm going to give credit to the kids.
Sona's thing. And I, you know, Theo was, I could hear him in the background. I'm like, oh, I got to kick Theo out now too, because he was just yakking in the background. It was so cute, but probably not good for recording purposes.
Yeah.
And so it's been really beautiful to see the transformation of hearts and souls. You know what's interesting too? I want, maybe we can end on this, or I wouldn't to hear it last from you guys. But earlier this week, there was a fight in Tennyson's classroom where one boy broke another boy's bracelet. And that boy just went to town on him and started beating him up and punching him. Tennyson came home really shaken up.
The first thing you told me as soon as we got in the car, you won't believe what happened in the classroom today. My two best friends or whatever started. Yeah.
Right. And again, amygdala reaction, right? Of just like, and again, I don't know what's happening at this boy's home.
I guess you can extrapolate.
And have so much compassion, right? Because I know what it's like to be the dysregulated parent. Mm-hmm. And it's so hard to be, it's hard to do self-parenting while parenting your own children. So there's zero judgment there. But this boy obviously has a very active amygdala. And so for his bracelet to be broken and he goes straight into an amygdala response and starts attacking this other boy, it really affected Tennyson to his core. And it's interesting because he and I have had conversations before where one of his closest friends, his older brother, beats up on his friend. And the reasoning for that is you have to learn to be a man. And so Tennyson's like, why don't we do that at our house? And I'm like, and I asked him, I'm like, do you think this world needs more violence? Mm-hmm. Do you think this world needs more harshness? And so I want to ask everyone that, do we need more of that energy? Do we need more dominance? Do we need more fighting?
Control, like, manipulation,
more control.
Fighting, violence, none of it.
We don't. And we don't need to teach our children that. We don't need it anymore. We never needed it. If we are to call in a higher conscious world, for ourselves and for our children, we need to realize that the way we were doing things don't serve us anymore. We can lay those down. We can leave them behind. We do not need to try and quote unquote raise strong boys to be men. That's bull. Like that is a belief system that we can burn at a stake and be done with, right? And just say, we need to raise sensitive boys to be sensitive men because the masculinity naturally grows out of them. It will naturally be there. But do you want masculinity to be like upon the foundation of emotionally intelligent boys, right? That know how to self-regulate and know how to take care of their emotions as well as the people around them.
And even for this boy that got so upset and beat the other kid up, it's really to teach them how to put words into feelings, right? Mm. And what is the feeling? The feeling is like, I'm really sad. I'm really hurt. This was my favorite bracelet. I just got it as a gift from for Christmas and you broke it. And that really hurts me, right?
Yeah.
But rather than, because they don't know how to do that, they go into violence to express how hurt they are.
Or that a boundary was crossed, right? Like I was letting you play with it, asking that you be careful and you didn't. So you betrayed my trust. You crossed the boundary.
And so this boy hasn't been taught how to use words to put to his emotions.
Which is understandable because they're still young. They're 8, 9-year-old kids.
Right.
But to go immediately into fight mode and not even like fight mode, like I'm going to do some damage. That's where curiosity, you have to just.
Like what is he exposed to in his world that is strengthening his amygdala muscle, for lack of a better word? Yeah. Although I guess the brain is a muscle. So, you know, that part of his brain.
Like, you do that with the kids too. It's like, it tends to, what are you feeling right now? I mean, you started doing that even before you met Ryan, but now we have his help. So it's a lot easier, right? Mm-hmm. But you are going to, what are you feeling right now versus focusing on the acting out?
You know, now with the kids, I'll be like, Tennyson, your lid is flipped. You're in your amygdala. Come, let's go before we start making decisions that we're going to regret.
Yeah.
So we have to remove him or we have to remove Satori because they're in their amygdala and they're like, all they see is red. And we have to like allow time to have their prefrontal cortex come back online. Mm-hmm. And so we're just narrating one, we're mirroring prefrontal cortex behavior. Like if they get
stay grounded,
don't start yelling at them. Don't shame them out of it. Like that's going to strengthen that amygdala response even more and create more self-loathing and self-hatred. Like we have to mirror prefrontal cortex. Like, hey, I'm here. Let's go somewhere. Do you need to punch a pillow? Like you're feeling
outlets for your anger
and narrating, like you're feeling big emotions right now.
Like how big is this emotion? Is this as big as the room?
Mm-hmm.
Is this as big as the state? Are you feeling an emotion that's as big as the world?
Right.
Is it bigger than the world?
Mm-hmm.
Satori's not good at naming her emotions. So trying to help her put language to her emotions would be really, really helpful.
Right. But but also one way to get them out of that prefrontal cortex is play.
Sure.
You know, so oftentimes, like here's an example with Tennyson. He was downstairs just thrashing like a wild animal. And I took out the sink. I sat with him. He closed himself in a closet and was kicking on the closet. You know, and so I pulled out some singing bowls and I started playing with the singing bowls. And like a minute later, he opened up the door. It was interesting because while he was in his amygdala just thrashing, I'm like, buddy, what is making you angry right now? What is it that triggered this? And he was just screaming at me. And so I pulled out the sound bowls. And literally within like 2 to 3 minutes, he comes out and he starts playing the sound bowls. And he's like, do you know what made me angry? And then he listed 3 things that happened earlier this week and today. And I was like, that's really great, buddy. But before he had no idea. And then he was so dysregulated. He was in his amygdala. And as soon as his prefrontal cortex got turned on because I was playing singing bowls. And so he started playing, he immediately shifted.
I wonder if the music though had an impact.
Oh,
like
sure.
The sound.
I absolutely right.
Music and play and distraction, you know, just
changed the energy.
It just changed the energy. The same thing happened with Satori this week where she was really mad about something. And so we went into their homework room and her fairy potion kit was out. And so I just started to play with it. And I was like, can you tell me about your fairy potion kit? And all of a sudden her energy changed because we're bringing in play. You know what I mean? So
yeah, because you're moving into a place of connection with your child.
Mm-hmm. And so if your kid is extremely disconnected, just try to gently bring them back to play. What is it that they're interested in right now? Is there a new toy? And be like, show me how this toy works or draw this picture for me or bring them to something that they just love in that moment or that week or something that's new and go into play. Exactly.
Yeah.
And move that energy. And then once their prefrontal cortex is turned on, that's when you get to play with them and then talk about what happened.
And interesting, there's two things that I want to talk about too really quickly. I know we're getting up in there. But the idea of a boundary, parents hate it because they'll say, my kids never listen. And the idea of a boundary is to not ask an unregulated child to put themselves in a state of regulation and behave correctly. A boundary is something that you do, not your child. So you can say, like, don't jump on the couch. Stop jumping on the couch. Mm-hmm. I don't know how many times I've told you jumping on the couch isn't safe. You're making requests. You're not setting a boundary. A boundary sounds like this. I see you want to jump on the couch, but I'm not going to let you do that. So if you jump on the couch again, I'm going to come over and move you. And you're the authoritarian and you move into a place where you set the boundary. A boundary isn't, hey, I'm requesting you to do something. A boundary is, here's what you need to do to behave correctly. Mm-hmm. And then you move into that place where the boundary is set. A boundary is incumbent upon you as the regulated parent to step in and create the boundary. I'm not going to let you hit your sibling. And then you move in because your number one job as a parent is to keep your kids safe. So you move in and create the boundary. It's not like, don't hit your sister. Hey, I told you not to hit your sister. If you do that again,
well, he continues to hit the sister.
Yes. Mm-hmm. Yeah. It's to immediately create the boundary. And that happens in so many places where if I hear myself ask my child to do something twice, I'm like, okay, now I have to be the boundary. Mm-hmm. So I'm just not going to do it twice.
And I don't know if you said this, but like their brain literally cannot do it.
It can't.
Like it's undeveloped. They cannot stop themselves. So don't make them feel bad for it.
Sure.
Their brain is undeveloped.
And they're hijacked and there's adrenaline going through their system. The adrenaline has to move through.
100%.
I mean, it's the energy that has to move through. So
100%. And so asking them to do something they developmentally cannot do is not fair. And you can go in and create that boundary while creating distraction. Be like, I'm going to remove you from the chair, but help me find that ball that you got this week. Let's go play with it.
If you want to hit something, hit this pillow, but
yes.
I'm not going to let you hit your sibling. Mm-hmm, right?
Exactly.
If you're feeling big emotions, let's go in this room and you can tear some paper.
I love when Tennyson was starting to regulate again, that he was able to articulate the three things that really bothered him that week. Mm-hmm. You know, they were like right there. He just needed the time to calm down a little bit and they communicate with you what really was upsetting him.
Oftentimes it's something that I'm like, oh my gosh, you were right, buddy. I wasn't consistent with my words. I will be very careful with what I promise and deliver on in future.
But
you know what I mean?
Even overarchingly more important is developing that system, that schema, that ability of I'm really dysregulated. Now I'm borrowing mom's calm or I'm mm-hmm. borrowing dad's calm and I'm now in a state of calm. Why was I so elevated? Why was I in that place? Mm-hmm. And then identifying it and then reconnecting, which goes right back into deep attachment theory as mm-hmm. far as secure attachments create really good, healthy relationships.
And it's also okay for us parents to own it when we mess up.
That's the
right.
Best
thing. The best. And to ask for forgiveness. He said, you're really right. I'm really sorry. I have never asked my kids, apologized to my kids without them accepting me immediately and forgiving me immediately. Well, it's okay, daddy. Like, no, it's not okay. I'm sorry that I yelled at you. That was wrong of me. That, you know, mm-hmm. to model the behavior, what it looks like. To own the fact that, hey, we're not perfect human beings as a person. We make mistakes too. We get dysregulated too. But when we own it and we're able to say, I'm really sorry that I did that. I'll try to do better next time. It's so good for them to model that, be on the receiving end.
Have that behavior modeled.
Yes.
Too. And then to have their experience validated by the person that's most central to their existence. To have a parent come back and be like, I should have done that. And I'm sure that hurt your feelings. And I am sorry. All of a sudden they're like, okay, I'm not trying to create stories around what happened because my mom obviously could never do that. My mom would mm-hmm. never. So I'm going to have to disassociate this part of me that's creating shame inside of me and push it away. Yeah. When you come to your children and you're quick to forgive, I say this with Shanique all the time. I'm like, repair quickly. We're going to make mistakes, but repair quickly.
So here's something that I think a lot of parents might resonate with, but I don't feel guilt for a lot of things because I know with everything I do it from the bottom, like with a whole heart and with all the integrity that I have. The one thing I've regretted the biggest in my life is how I raised Tennyson the first 5 years of his life, because I knew he was sensory sensitive, but I didn't know to what extent.
And
I
had no,
like my brain couldn't compute how he was mm-hmm. and I didn't know how to parent it. I didn't have the tools or the language or the experience or anyone modeling to me how he needed to be parented. Two, Tristan was dying. So Tennyson didn't have a lot of my bandwidth.
Yeah,
he didn't have a lot of my time. I was in survival mode. So I was dysregulated, and I was a dysregulated parent raising a very dysregulated child. He was born dysregulated. He came out screaming and didn't stop for like a year. And so he was colicky and all the things. And so it's funny. So I've cried often to Ryan, just like, I have so many regrets. I have so many regrets. And so as I'm healing and regulating and Tennyson is healing, it's funny. He doesn't remember a lot of stuff about his dad, but he'll remember a lot of things of my parenting. And he'll be like, Mom, do you remember that time that you did X, Y, and Z? And I'm like, I did what? And he's like, yeah, you said, did it. And I would be like, I am, buddy. I didn't know what I was doing back then. I am so, so sorry. Like, can you please forgive me? And he'll be like, it'll be $1 million, you know? And like,
I like how he negotiates.
He's like, yeah, he's like, that'll be $500. And like, it's always like money to him. You know what I mean? Mm-hmm. But like, it's healing it to him to hear me apologize. At first I was like, this isn't going to do anything. It's not going to reprogram all the trauma I've given him.
It's very important for us to be honest when we make a mistake, right, to own it, mm-hmm, and for them to see what it looks like to own it.
Yep. But like, we're closer. Like Tennyson, he, remember when at the beginning of this episode, I'm like, he told his therapist that he and I used to fight all the time. We're closer now. Yeah. Like he comes and he snuggles me and he holds me. And when he's dysregulated, he comes to me and he'll even tell me what he needs, you know? And I'm like, oh my gosh, sorry, I'm here. You have my undivided attention. You know what I mean? And so
the lesson from that too is it's never too late. Mm-hmm. It just is never too late.
Yes.
So if you as a parent are feeling guilty about how you've raised your kids or mistakes you've made, it's okay. We all feel that. That is a common emotion. The uncommon thing is going to your kids and saying, I'm sorry, and owning it. That's the key move, is saying, shoot, I have regrets. So I'm going to do better. And I'm going to make sure that I repair with my kids.
Because the future is determined by the choices we make today.
Sure.
That's it. So every day is a new start.
So how do we want to end this episode, you guys, on divine masculinity?
You're welcome. Those of you who are still listening, thank you.
Right. Right.
Yeah.
No, but really, how do we want to end it? Silence.
I mean, I think we've said it. I think, you know, divine masculine and divine feminine, side by side, hand in hand, creating a beautiful culture, creating a beautiful world. But creating one family at a time, one relationship at a time, with one child at a time.
Just when you are raising your boys, just know like they are highly sensitive and that's okay. Like protect that for them, because it's going to grow something really beautiful inside of them. And that's going to be the healthy masculine. It's not going to turn them into a female, I promise. It's going to create a really beautiful human that the future needs and deserves. Yeah. Like, we all deserve a better future. And this is how we call that in. So you guys, thanks for listening. You guys, thanks for being on the podcast. I had to beg Ryan. He didn't want to come.
I have imposter syndrome.
I know.
It's real.
The wrong people have imposter syndrome, babe. Do. And happy birthday, Elio.
Thank you.
I adore you.
I love you.
And you know that. So
I love you both.
Amen.
And I'm so proud of both of you and how you're raising your family. It's just wonderful to witness.
Thank you. And listeners, we'll catch you next week. Thanks for listening. Thanks for being a part of not only your internal healing, but the healing of
the rest of the world.
For the rest of the world and this planet. It starts with these heartfelt conversations that we have on these podcasts that you can take to your children and your families and hopefully plant seeds slowly but surely.
So, amen.
So we'll catch you guys next week.
Oh, wow.
Thank you for listening to the Gutsy Health Podcast. We hope you enjoyed and learned a lot from this episode. For more updates, follow us on Instagram @GutsyHealthPodcast.